Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director of the Lowy Institute, and it's my pleasure to be welcoming you here today to the launch of the G20 and the Future of International Economic Governance. I'm particularly pleased, of course, to welcome the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Glenn Stevens. Let me come back and mention Glenn and the other speakers in a second. As many of you will know, I was honoured this year to deliver the Boyer Lectures, and I called my second Boyer Lecture a three-dimensional foreign policy. And I argued in that lecture that we've always pursued a three-dimensional foreign policy as a means of keeping Australia prosperous and safe. And the dimensions of which I speak are height, depth and width, where height is our practice of working with like-minded great powers like Britain and the United States. Depth means building strong relations with the countries around us in Asia, and width involves participating in the activities of international institutions. And it's that third dimension, width, that this great new book explores. Australians are joiners by instinct and practice, and I think at some level we understand that a country of our size benefits greatly from an international order in which the rules of the road are well established and widely observed. And as a result, governments of both colours have been concerned to join and sometimes to erect and to strengthen institutions through which they can influence global institutions, global decisions, I should say. We've had some odd debates in recent years about the value of sitting on the G20 or the value of sitting on the UN Security Council, but I hope that those debates are now behind us. Certainly, the recent change in prime ministers, at least from my perspective, seems to have enlivened Australia's interest in multilateral institutions. I thought it was very interesting that only a week or two after the change, Australia announced that we would seek seats on both the Security Council and the Human Rights Council. That certainly feels like a deliberate signal from the government that we are doubling down on this dimension of our foreign policy, the width dimension. We will look to see how this new government attitude is reflected in our involvement at the G20 Leaders Summit in Antalya in a few weeks' time and in China next year. It's almost a year since Australia hosted a successful G20 Leaders Summit in Brisbane. We're delighted and pleased that the G20 Studies Centre here at the Institute continues to lead the debate on the G20 and its future. The scholarship in this book has captured the lessons learned through Australia's leadership of the G20, and I think it will contribute to strengthening the forum in the future. I want to congratulate very warmly the two editors, Mike Callahan and Tristram Sainsbury, as well as all the contributors. Let me also recognise a couple of people who are here today from New South Publishing, Kathy Bale and Philippa McGuinness. From the G20 Studies Centre, Hannah Wirth, who made a large contribution to this book, as she does to all the centre's activities. Let me also congratulate everybody involved in publishing this book for getting it out just in time for Christmas and the beach. Personally, I can't imagine, it's either this or the new Robert Harris thriller on Caesar and Cicero for me at beach time. Let me tell you how this event will work. First, Glenn Stevens will launch the book. Then we will hear from Mike Callahan, one of the authors. We'll hear from Sue Harris, one of the contributors. And finally, Tristram will offer the vote of thanks. So you'll see a lot of faces in a short period of time, a bit like when Australia bats at Trent Bridge. Ladies and gentlemen, Glenn Stevens is known to everyone in this room. He has been the governor of the RBA since 2006, having first joined the bank in 1980. Prior to being governor, he was deputy governor from 2001. As well as representing Australia on international financial bodies, he's been a visiting scholar at many prestigious universities and institutions. Glenn is a veteran of the G20 trenches, and he has both the scars and the battle honours to prove it. We are honoured that he agreed to launch this book. Let me invite Glenn Stevens to the podium.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and good morning to you all. I'm particularly pleased to be here to take part in the launch of this book because, as Michael said, I've been going to the G20 a long time, since about 2004 or 5, and I think I'm the only central bank governor, actually, who has been a host of the ministers and governors process twice. So I kind of feel I have some credibility to say a few things about the G20. Let me say that I think the success of the Australian presidency, and I think it was successful, owed a lot to the efforts of Joe Hockey and his team at the ministerial level. He did an excellent job in leading the ministerial process, and his energy and ideas and enthusiasm, coupled with the competence and experience of key officials, people like Martin Parkinson, Barry Stirland and others, meant that the Australian presidency, I think, had an impact on the G20. Those outside the official tent, of course, also have contributed. Those who led in the B20 process and the various other 20 processes, of which there are many now, all played a prominent and important role in a successful presidency for us. Let me pay credit to the Lowy Institute for your efforts here. An interest in the G20 process, both ahead of and during and indeed after the Australian presidency. It was very astute on the part of the Lowy Institute to get Mike Callaghan involved. Mike, of course, has spent way too many nights in G20 communique drafting sessions, and I can see him grimly nodding as I say that. So it's good to see work like this being produced. As in most things, it's important to take stock of the performance of the G20, to assess its strengths and its achievements and areas of possible improvement. It's only through that type of reflection that the effectiveness of the G20 and other bodies can be improved. Why is the G20 important? Well, we live in an interconnected world, so international dialogue has become and will further become more important in managing the world economy and in addressing problems that can only be solved through joint efforts as opposed to unilateral ones. In addition, I think it's clear that the older structures of the G7 and G8 no longer can command the legitimacy and credibility that they once might have, nor can they engineer the degree of genuine cooperation more broadly across the global community that we really need. So while the G20 was in a way conceived in a hurry at the time of the Asian crisis, it was an idea whose time had come. Had it not been invented then, we'd have had to invent something like it before long. And I think the G20's had some successes. I don't think there's any doubt that at the time of the initial leaders' summits in the height of the financial crisis, those meetings were pivotal in crafting the response to the problems. The crisis started in the major countries, but it turned global. And the G20 leadership got together and they sounded like they had a plan and they believed the plan would work to save the world. And that actually, even though that was mostly words, that was pivotal at the time. I would like to think that our efforts in our presidency to put growth and infrastructure on the agenda will pay dividends as well. We don't know how all that will turn out yet. It's too early to tell, but I think they were important steps. More recently, the issue of international tax reform, which is being progressed in the G20, this is another area where unilateral action can't solve the problem and where we need collective action to deal with the very important issues there. So the G20 is important. Perhaps because of its successes in some areas, you can see very clearly that various other causes get attached to the G20 train in the hope of being pulled along out of the station as the G20 train departs. This is clear in the book, actually. Those advocating reforms in trade, tax, energy, climate, development, and so on are all nominating the G20 as the key body and asking it to do more. Now, that's quite striking to me, actually, as one who's been involved in the G20 process for a long time now, particularly given that some say the G20 has lost momentum. Now, I mean, in some ways it was inevitable that there'd be some sense of loss of momentum after those initial leaders' summits, because you can't run this on just pure adrenaline in a crisis setting permanently. We certainly tried to restart the momentum, I think with some success, in our presidency. But the fact is that a lot of other interested parties are hanging on to the G20 as the way forward, and the expectations of the G20 are therefore going up quite a lot. It may be that for the G20 to increase its own momentum, the thing to do is to grasp a couple of these issues and try to succeed where others have failed. That would cement the G20's place as the preeminent body for global governance. But of course, that's not without challenge. The reason that others have failed to achieve these things is they're not easy. And so the risk for the G20 is overreach and failure itself, which would then consign it to irrelevance. So this is a pretty big set of calls for the G20 and its various countries and participants to make. If you take the thorny question of IMF quota and governance reform, one which has been in a topic of international debate at these meetings for the entire time I've been going to them and will continue for a long time, some progress has been made and the G20 can help here, but the fact is, I think, that ultimately it's in the IMF membership and in the key national jurisdictions in that membership that the key decisions ultimately have to be taken. The G20 can facilitate that, but there's no G20 communique that I can think of that can actually take the step itself. So they're big issues, but they'll be for others to judge, not me, as we go forward. My final point simply would be that this is all very important for Australia. We're a mid-sized economy with a small population. We're being equaled in that respect and in GDP terms and overtaken by some of our Asian trading partners. We're not a natural member of any of the G groups, in my opinion. There are some historical circumstances, accidental in some ways, that explain why we're in the G20. We only hold a place in this group or any other, not by having powerful friends, but by having the other participants think that we're useful to have at the table. That means contributing on the issues in a way that's globally relevant, not just being narrowly partisan. That's a luxury that only large countries can afford. We can't. It means putting in the effort in a targeted way. It means doing the travel, bearing the costs and so on to make our contribution worthwhile. I think we've been doing that. In no small measure due to people of the calibre of Mike and others in the Treasury and the Bank and elsewhere. But there's a lot at stake here and a continual effort's required. So in that light, it's very good to see this work at Lowy going on. It's good to see it being published. Having looked through the book, it's full of substance and thought-provoking ideas, so I want to compliment you, Michael, and your team, Mike and Tristan and others, on the work you've done, for the commitment that the Institute has shown to talking about the G20 and about Australia's role in it, and I'm very pleased to be here to launch the book. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Glenn, for making time in your busy schedule to speak, but also for giving us a short speech, nevertheless of substance, with real diamonds in there. And in particular, the last point that Glenn made about a country of Australia's size rising or falling on the quality of our ideas and our effort. I think it's a really important point, and thank you for making it. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce Mike Callahan, one of the editors of the book, and of course all the credit for the book goes to Mike and Tris. Mike is the doyen, I would say, of the G20 world. He's a non-resident fellow here at the Lowy Institute. He led the G20 Study Centre at the Institute, including through our presidential year. He has extensive experience on international economics in the Treasury, the IMF. He was our finance G20 finance deputy, but I don't think the bare bones of his CV really capture the extent to which everybody in the G20 loves Mike. And I was reflecting on how I could sum this up. And as some of you know, I'm an American politics junkie, and you remember that famous speech when John F. Kennedy took Jackie Kennedy to Paris. And even though he was the president, this was in 1961, he was the president, but everybody was looking at Jackie and her gowns, and he gave this famous speech where he said, "I am the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and I have enjoyed it." Well, I attended the St. Petersburg summit with Mike Callaghan, and although I was the director of the Lowy Institute, I can tell you I got no attention. We'd go into rooms together and people would flock from all sides. "Mike, Mike, thank goodness you're back. We need you, Mike." So I am the man who accompanied Mike Callaghan to St. Petersburg, and I have enjoyed it. I very much enjoyed working with Mike, both in St. Petersburg and the time he had working in this building and since, and I'm delighted to ask him to say a few words.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for those very kind words, Michael. And thank you, Glenn, for agreeing to launch this book, because there is no other Australian, I think, who is more fitting to launch a book on the G20 than Glenn, because as Michael and Glenn himself have said, he is a veteran of the G20. In fact, I think there's no other Australian who has attended more G20 finance ministers and central bank governors meetings than Glenn. And I suspect he's very close to having the record of attending these meetings across all nations. Now, you have to have attended some of these to realise what an achievement that is. It says something about Glenn. I'm not quite sure what it says, but it does say something about Glenn. Certainly says something about his stamina. Now, the main thing I have to say is thank you. Thank you to the Lowy Institute, the University of New South Wales Press, and most importantly, the contributors who made this book possible. And some of them are here. There's Sue, there's Fari, there's Steve, and there's Tris. Of course, a book published in Australia in November 2015 on international economic governance and the G20 may seem to be a year late. As we all know, the Brisbane G20 summit was in November 2014, and the G20 seems to be so last year in Australia. Let's face it, it's one Australian Prime Minister ago, and no one's talking about the G20 in Australia. Now, to me, that does sum up a bit of the problem. G20 gets attention in the country chairing the summit, but seems to be off the radar other times. It's certainly not part of the domestic economic debate. So why did we produce a book on the G20 in the year after Australia was chairing the G20? Mainly because the issues the G20 is grappling with, they do remain very relevant. And perhaps because the importance of international economic cooperation doesn't get the attention it should. Now, the origin of this book was a conversation I had with Anthony Bubbalo about the middle of last year, while I was still working in this building in the Lowy and in the G20 Study Centre, busy writing papers and organising conferences and everything in relation to the Australian chairing of the G20 in 2014. And Anthony is the Director of Research at Lowy. And I'd like to say that conversation was a deep and meaningful discussion of the importance of international economic governance and what we could do to contribute it. But things are not like that. I think it was more a case of Anthony sitting on the edge of the desk and saying, "We ought to do something next year." And I think I was a bit reluctant, thinking it's time to move on. But Anthony, he persevered, and he said we should build on the work that we had done on the G20. And he was right, and we talked about the possibility of holding a conference and then seeing if we could publish a book. And one thing led to another, and we did have a conference on the future of international economic governance and the G20 in May this year, and all the contributors in the book participated and presented papers at that conference, and as a result, we now have a book. In terms of fleshing out what we wanted to achieve, we decided that it was worthwhile to have some reflection on what was achieved in the G20 under the Australian G20 presidency, but in particular to focus on the future and where the world may be heading when it comes to international economic cooperation. And the aim was to produce a book that was targeted to a wider audience than that very, very small band of dedicated G20 followers and commentators. We decided to continue the approach we had followed in the G20 Study Centre in the lead up to the Brisbane Summit and not focus on the general broad topic of international economic governance and international economic architecture, but rather zero in on the specific issues confronting the global economy that require cooperation between countries and see what value the G20 can make. In terms of those issues, we focused on international tax, international trade, globally operating financial institutions, energy, climate change, the performance of international institutions, and of course, growth in the global economy. Now, we focused on these issues because we live in an increasingly integrated world, and these are issues that cannot be solved by any one country unilaterally. They are issues that do require international cooperation. Last month, the IMF Managing Director noted, for what appears to have been the umpteenth time, that global growth remains disappointing, uneven, and international cooperation is never more vital. As she went on to say, quote, given the collective nature of the issues involved, like climate change, trade, and global financial safety net, international cooperation is more urgent than ever before. So that was the plan, to try and pull together a book that focused on assessing how the world was going and providing that much needed international cooperation to deal with these pressing international issues. As to who was going to contribute to this project, basically, it was from my time working on international economic issues in Treasury for many, many years, and also at the Lowy Institute for 2 years, I asked the people who impressed me. We wanted a mix of views, backgrounds, and approaches, but the common denominator is that we wanted people who had something to say, something interesting to say. And we wanted people who were objective, not what I would call members of or international groupies or members of the international club. That is, people who work on general international economic issues, go from one international meeting to another, divorced from the reality of domestic economic and political issues. Because you have to be involved in the domestic economic and political issues if you really want to see progress on these issues. So we wanted contributors who were realistic, objective, and prepared to call it as it is. I asked people who were experts in specific issues like trade, energy, tax, financial regulation, people such as Fari. I also asked some leading academics on international governance issues such as Sue. And I asked some former government officials from the US, India, and the UK, like Steve Pickford, who's here. These are people I worked with on the G20 when I was in the Australian Treasury. They were people with direct experience of the inner workings of the G20 and official international meetings and international institutions. And we wanted a distinguished journalist to provide an assessment as to how well international economic issues are being communicated to the wider public, and was pleased that Michelle Grattan agreed to contribute. And I was pleased that all the people I contacted agreed to take part in the project. I thank them enormously because I do think they're responsible for an interesting book. There are a difference of views, as there should be, in the book. For example, there are different views as to the performance of Australia as G20 chair in 2014. Some assessments are more positive than others. So what's the overall assessment of the future of international economic governance? Well, if you read the book, you'll realise there are a variety of views. But my assessment is that those who have been grappling with the international economic challenges confronting the world are not overly optimistic that the necessary level of cooperation needed to deal with these issues is coming from the existing international economic institutions and forums to the extent required. And that includes the G20. Yet, as Christine Lagarde said, international economic cooperation is now more urgent than ever before. There is, unfortunately, a view that some think we probably need a crisis, another crisis, to focus the minds again around the importance of cooperation. So we do need to work harder to get the cooperation we need to make the forums such as the G20 more effective. And the contributors in this book have put forward a number of ideas in that regard. Of course, such assessments depend on whether you are a glass half full or a glass half empty type of person. You can focus on the shortcomings and inherent problems in the G20 and throw your hands up in desperation. Michelle Grattan's chapter in the book has an interesting quote from Bob Carr when he attended the G20 Leaders Summit in St. Petersburg in 2013. As filling in as the leader, because it was the day Labor lost the election. And as Bob Carr recorded in his diary, quote, as I'm looking at these 20 nations, I also think every one of them has trouble selling reform in its own community. There are no slashing reformers here. Yet the communique, already agreed on, has a commitment to structure reform at its centrepiece, unrealisable, especially in the form of the courageous coordinated action like the commitment to stimulus and avoiding recession that justified the G20 in the first place. But if you are a glass half full type of person with a more optimistic bent, when confronted with the apparent impossibility of getting international coordinated action to deal with some pressing global issues, you could take comfort from another quote in the book, and that's from Arthur C. Clarke's observation. Every revolutionary idea seems to invoke three stages of reaction. One, it's completely impossible. Two, it's possible but not worth doing. And three, I said it was a good idea all along. So to conclude, thank you to the contributors of the book. Thank you to Trish Sainsbury, a co-editor. Thank you to Hannah Wirth, who has done a tremendous job in helping to get this book out. Thank you to Anthony Bubbelow. Thank you to Michael Fullilove. Thank you to the Lowy Institute, and thank you to the New South Wales University Press. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Glenn complimented me on recruiting Mike to head up the G20 Study Centre, but as you can see, I had no choice because he's such a unique combination of intelligence, experience, expertise, and public spiritedness, and Mike's fingerprints are on every page of this book. So congratulations, Mike. Thank you also for mentioning Anthony Bubbelow, who's with us today, our research director, who has a very important role in all the intellectual output of the Institute, including everything that the G20 Studies Centre has done. As for Arthur C. Clarke, I said this book was a good idea all along. Let me introduce the next speaker, Sue Harris. Associate Professor Susan Harris-Rimmer, I should say, is the Australian Research Council Future Fellow at Griffith Law School and an adjunct reader in the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the ANU. She is one of the liveliest writers and speakers we have in Australia on questions of global governance. She, as Mike said, she's a contributor to this book and has been extensively involved in both the T20 process and the W20 process. She attended, I believe, the St. Petersburg Summit in 2013 and the Brisbane Summit in 2014. We're delighted to have you with us. Please come and say a few words.
Thank you, Michael. It's delightful to be here. It's wonderful for you to launch the book, Mr. Stevens. And I have to say, one of the funniest phone calls of my life was talking to the Reserve Bank of Australia media team when I described Glenn as a rock star of global economic governance and was urged to consider the alternative term, respected actor. No, we're going with rock star. I'm sorry. You seem to invite these colourful phrases, which you do not use yourself. And poor Michael gets called all kinds of things. I've seen you in a Gaddafi uniform in a slide. So, look, I'm here to tell you a few things. First, I just want to acknowledge my fellow representative to the W20 and forward. So we've made a bit of history ourselves with the W20 Forum recently, one of the new proliferations of the outreach actors of the G20, but it's a very important one because it's trying to increase the appeal and the interest of the G20 to half the world's population who really have not factored heavily in the G20 up to this point. So look, three reasons why this book is very important. The first reason is it's incredibly readable. You have not been edited until you've been edited by a chief of staff. Other chiefs of staff in the room, you could probably agree this, but it's intensely readable. So if you are a non-economist seeking to engage with the G20, as I was 6 years ago, this is the book for you. There is very little readable material on the G20, you know, if you're not a very technical-minded person. And if you're a governance scholar, it's even worse usually. So this is a readable book, it's a practical book, it's a useful book, and it contains within it a couple of things that make it readable and useful. The first is that the contributions are targeted and argumentative. They have full of data, but they're also trying to make a point, trying to make an argument, and all of these contributions are inspired by the idea that we want better global governance, that we want more solutions to the plethora of problems that the world is facing. Some of us are dedicated multilateralists, some of us are not, and it makes for a really interesting read. But what you also get are these deep lived experiences of officials from India, Canada, Australia, who give you insights, China, to give you insights into what it has been like to have this semi-Bretton Woods moment where we're trying to deal with the way power is shifting around the globe. We're also trying to deal with the fact economic power is more important these days than military power in some senses. Everything is changing. The world of trade is changing. The world of global governance is radically changing. If you want to keep up to date with the future, you have to read books like this. So this is why you're going to take it to the beach, yeah? Okay, the second reason that it's very, very important is because it's grappling with the biggest issues of the time. Australia is still part of the G20, is still leading the G20, and that's a point we need to underline very carefully. We are part of the Troika, period, with, for just a little while longer. Australia, Turkey and China is one of those moments in global economic governance when non-G8 people are leading the economic governance conversation for the first time. It's very important when you think of it. A Muslim nation for the first time is leading the conversation on economic governance. China for the first time is going to be able to display its credentials as a maker of rules. This is a very important historical moment. I think most people will be very excited by the China summit next year. And so this, if you've never been interested in global economic governance before, and maybe you haven't, that's fine. But if you haven't, this is the moment. This is absolutely the moment you want to be engaging with these issues. Third reason that you need to think about this book is because it is a uniquely Australian contribution to the conversation. I've been very worried that there is not the epistemic community in Australia, not the domestic discussions about the G20 that they should have been, even when we hosted the summit. Where were the debates about the growth plan? Where is the pressure on the budget next year to reflect the growth measures? Where is the debate about how we're going to meet our target to reduce the gap between female labour participation and male labour participation? One thing to make the claim, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to get there? Those are domestic political conversations that we need to have. And they are happening in rarefied spaces. The B20 are having good conversations, but they're not happening in public spaces, with ordinary people. And that's the kind of conversations that I'm really looking at that I hope this book will contribute to. And thank you so much to New South for taking a punt on this kind of conversation and building that constituency. In academia, it's pretty sad, I have to say, that we don't really have the scholarship that we need in this area if Australia is going to take a leading role. So it's very important that Loie keep this contribution. So the final reason, why are you going to take this book to the beach? Well, because it's got some great lines in it. Now, Michael, I know, loves speeches, made a few decent ones of his own recently, congratulations. So I want to read you as close as economists get to poetry, right? It's just as close as economists get, so I want you to listen carefully. This is the 2009 London Summit Communique, and this book is haunted by the spectre of the financial crisis and the prospect that it will come again. And to my mind, the G20 has already proved very important in that respect. Anything we can do to identify and prevent systemic crisis is incredibly important. So the leader said in April 2009, we start from the belief that prosperity is indivisible, that growth to be sustained has to be shared, and that our global plan for recovery must have at its heart the needs and jobs of hardworking families, not just in developed countries, but in emerging markets and the poorest countries of the world. Now, last night, Credit Suisse put out its report saying that finally the Oxfam prediction has come to pass. The 1% now own 50% of the wealth. It's very important that the G20 keeps this conversation about inequality and what we're going to do to promote the indivisibility of prosperity. So thank you very much. Read the book.
That was excellent. Thank you, Susan. I loved the three reasons as to why we should buy the book, the readability and the argumentativeness and the importance of the issues. I'd love to see that as a book review in the Herald or the Courier Mail. I don't know if as a contributor to the book you're sort of banned from reviewing it, but you shouldn't be. Thank you very much. Finally, let me call on the other editor of the book, Tristram Sainsbury. Tris is a research fellow at the Institute, a driving force of our G20 study centre. He's been with the Institute for about a year. He's made a big impression on us. He's a dynamo. We like working with him. Previously, he was at the Treasury where he worked on G20 policy, among many other issues. Tris, to move the vote of thanks.
Thank you very much, Michael. I still have a way to go to get to Rockstar. So just a couple of very quick thank yous before we go for food, because I know I'm standing in the way of an important occasion. So first, just to Governor Glenn Stevens for making the time to launch the book. The RBA is actually quite central to Australia's participation in the G20, and the G20 Study Centre has been long grateful for the RBA's support for our events, and this has been over a long period of time. To the publishers at New South, especially Philippa and Kathy, who are here today, you made the book publication process smooth and easy, and it's all to the Institute, to the Lowy Institute, for providing such a supportive environment for writing the book, especially to Michael, to Anthony, to Su Yin, and to Leon. To all of the contributing authors for their efforts, it's been great to have Sue, Fari, Steve all here today. To Mike, particularly to Mike, who's had the idea of the book, who drove the project, even editing on a plane from Cairns. And finally, to Hannah Wirth, who our research associate, who has been helping out on basically all of the aspects of the book. It's been a great experience, actually, and I'm very proud of the final result. So with that, I'd just like to say thank you for all coming, and enjoy your food.
Let me finish. Thank you again for coming. The Institute is very proud of this book. We're a research institute first and foremost, and that means publishing research at long lengths as well as at short lengths, and we're very proud of this contribution to the debate. So thank you to our colleagues from New South. Thank you to everybody and all the contributors, and especially again, thank you to Governor Stevens. Thank you.